as we're settling down together into the middle part of the rains retreat. Getting used to the schedule, getting used to the practice. As we stay on retreat, sometimes the things which were difficult at the start of the retreat become easier, becomes more normal and natural to spend periods of time by oneself. You get into a rhythm with meditation, and gradually, without even really noticing it, the meditation becomes more peaceful and more flowing more easily. But at the same time, it's also easy to, as the retreat goes on, it's easy to get a bit complacent, to get a bit lazy, to forget how rare the opportunity is to practice, to forget how much we've all had to give up to be here, and how much so many other people have had to give up to support us and to keep us here. So it's important to keep that bit of edge in our practice. A little bit of roughness to it. And it's part of the forest tradition as well. You know, when I was a musician, I never used to like music that was too smooth or too refined. Always like something that had a bit of edge in it, that was a little bit unfinished, where you could hear some of the squeak on the strings or the clicks when the musician moved their fingers. And to me, this is the attitude in the forest tradition. We don't try to be slick, don't try to put on a performance. What we do try to do is be authentic to what the practice is, to what our aims are, to what the Buddha was teaching. And what I wanted to talk about this evening was to carry on from some of the topics raised in the Sutta class yesterday. And I know in the Sutta class, when we're discussing the text, we can get caught up in the details of things, and we can lose the wider perspective of the kind of the meaning and the significance of them, which is okay. That's what the sutta classes are for. They're for working out what the details of things are. But tonight I want to reflect more on the meaning of some things, and especially on the meaning of the fourfold group of dhammas, which were mentioned a few times in the verses we looked at from the Parayanavaga, and that group is the Ditta, Sutta, Mutta, Vinyata, the seen, heard, thought, and cognized, or I guess cognized is probably the best one. Mentioned that there's a variation in how this is interpreted, that according to the mainstream Pali tradition, the third factor here, mutta, is usually translated as sensed and is taken to include the smell, taste and touch, whereas actually the real meaning of it is thought, what has been thought out, what is seen, heard, thought and cognized. It's a very significant difference, and it's very revealing when you see these changes being made in the tradition. The purpose of that change is to make this group of four fit in with the group of six in the Samayatana, the six senses. And it disguises the actual context that these four appeared in, both in Buddhism and also in the earlier Upanishads. And that context is, how do we come to know, and especially how do we come to have spiritual knowledge or liberating or religious wisdom? So this is what I'd like to talk about for this evening. Now, according to Buddhism, when we talk about what beings are or what we are, we always use the word sentient beings as a kind of Buddhist hybrid English phrase. So the word sentient beings doesn't exactly correspond with any particular Indic phrase, but it captures the idea well enough that what we are essentially is beings who know. We're conscious. That's the critical thing. And it's very important to remember this, that knowing, being aware, is actually the central fact of our whole existence. And this is why unknowing, avidya, is at the head of dependent origination. Knowing is that which undoes the dependent origination. The Dhamma only matters because we know, because we feel, because we're aware. The Buddha said he taught Vediya Manasa to one who feels. And this relates to one of the differences in Western psychology. A very very simplistically, but Freud believed that the basic drive of humanity was to feel pleasure. And coincidentally, the word Freud means pleasure or joy. And then his student Adler said that humanity's greatest drive was the drive for power. And again, coincidentally or not, his name, Adler, means eagle. And then Jung came along and said, no, the basic drive that people have is the drive to know, to be conscious. This is more fundamental than anything else. Not to say those other drives aren't important, but the most basic thing we are is conscious beings. The most basic form of pleasure is the pleasure of knowing something. Before we are anything else, we are sentient. And that's why we matter, that's why the Dhamma matters. So given that we're trapped in suffering because of our unknowing, because of our avidya, because how we know isn't good enough, how we know doesn't tell us the whole story, how we know is deluded and twisted. So the practice is to know better, to know more clearly, to untangle the tangle. So this question of how we know has always been one of the prime aspects of Buddhism, both practice and theory. And one of the ways of expressing that is in this formula, Ditta, Sutta, Mutta, Vinyata. seen, heard, sensed and cognized, which, as I mentioned before, is not originally Buddhist, it's pre-Buddhist. It's found in the Upanishads and so quite aptly referred to several times in the Parayanavaka, where the Buddha's debating with some Brahmins or discussing with some Brahmins about these questions. So, now how we know as sentient beings, we know through sight, sound, smell, taste, and touch, and through our mind. So when we're addressing the kind of the basic question of our existential status, who we are, what we are, then this is the group, the six senses, which the Buddha always referred to. But this group, the group of four, is a bit different. It's not meant to be complete in this way. It's meant to look at what are those ways of knowing where we come to know the truth in an existential or in a liberating sense, a soteriological sense. The truth that frees us. And so the minor senses are dropped out, smelling, tasting and touching. Are omitted because these are relatively, not completely obviously, but relatively unimportant for spiritual life. Things which are much more important, seeing, hearing, thinking, and the awareness of vijnana. These are the things which are most central and most important in spiritual practice. And it's very much how we are oriented as our kind of sentient beings, isn't it? We tend to be very visually oriented. We have, you know, our eyes are on the front of our heads, and we see. We have depth vision and so on. We see good colour and all of those kinds of things. So our vision is very good compared to many different animals, for example. Similarly, our hearing is also very good. A sense of smell, not so good compared to many animals. If we were sentient dogs, for example, then we might rearrange the senses and put them in a phrase and emphasise different ones. But for humans, these are the ones which are most important. Now these are most important for seeing and hearing are very important as primary senses. So just in their ordinary everyday sense, we still use these a lot and we still rely on them for spiritual practice. So for example, reading, when we read Dhamma books and so on, so we're relying on a sense of sight. Of course, that wasn't the case in the Buddha's time, but it is today. So in the Buddha's time, the learning of doctrines was done entirely through hearing, in the sense of sound. It's quite a different modality. And India is the only culture in the world which attain to a high level of philosophy without a written culture, or without the philosophy being written down in any case. In Greece you had the origins of philosophy before it was written down. But the developed forms of the philosophy were definitely written down. Whereas in India it happened much later. So there's that more, that orientation towards hearing, as we find, of course, at the beginning of every discourse, evam me sutam. But that's not to say that seeing is also not very important. Of course, seeing is very important for human beings, recognizing people, seeing things like body language and all of the subliminal signs and so on. So we still learn a lot from our sight, even if we're not learning the actual texts from sight. And in addition, we've seen as we've studied the various meditations which have been taught in Buddhism that many of those meditations are sight-oriented. So we see that many of them are, kusinas, we see colours or imagining the parts of the body and so on. So many of those meditations have a visual aspect to them. So what's seen, heard, thought, and cognized. So the more significant meaning or implication of this, what's seen and what's heard, is not just the physical senses, as I emphasized yesterday, but also the, the derived or inferred use of these. Dipta, what's seen, what's dipta is what views you have, what opinions you have. And what's sutta is what's heard, the oral tradition, what you've learned, the text that you've learned. So we just recited the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, so that's what's sutta. Of course, in the ancient tradition, what was heard in that sense, in Sanskrit they call it the Shruti, is the ancient Vedas, which were believed to have been divinely inspired, like literally spoken by the gods, and heard, heard mentally by the oldest sages of the Rig Veda, who listened to what the gods say and recited them, and this is where the ancient texts come from. So it's important to bear in mind this context, that texts in those days were not just something, it's not like today where text has become so debased. I mean, these days you can kind of go online and you go onto a newspaper site or a blog or Facebook or something, and everybody, feels perfectly inclined to just put whatever their opinion is at the moment. So they just kind of splatter any old random thought or unreflective idea or whatever, and then that becomes text, and we've got this incredible glut of words and text, far greater amount of quantity of text being produced today than at any other time in human history. In those days, human words were hardly considered worth recording. There were records of human teachers and so on before the Buddha, but the primary texts were always those texts which were inspired by the gods. And to record a text, to actually go to the effort of memorizing it, was a very, very rare thing. It only happened to a small number of people, and in a small number of cases. And there's nothing that's even vaguely comparable to the Buddhist scriptures in the whole Indic cultural sphere. In fact, in the whole world, there's no comparable quantity, size of literature, especially in literature in an oral tradition, but I think even just any kind of literature that stems from one person, from one teacher. Of course, the Vedic and Brahmanical literature is a comparable size, but it stems from many different teachers compiled over a period of 1,000 years. The Jaina literature was composed much later, so it doesn't really compare. So we had this unprecedented and unequaled effort to remember, to pass down the particular teachings of this particular teacher, unlike anything that had happened before. Putting together, you remember that the great comparison with the Buddhist was always the Brahmanical tradition, and that was a whole caste of society. It was a whole class that had passed down for hundreds of years, and they'd passed down what they called their Veda, which is the knowledge. So the knowledge of the culture was what had been heard by the ancient seers and then passed down through the Veda, through the knowledge. And that was how you came to know, how you came to have this sutta, the second factor of the second of these four ways of knowing. So what I'm trying to bring out or to draw out here is that these things had much more of a pregnant resonance, much more of a spiritual, they would evoke a spiritual response in those times. So they are the outcome of a great spiritual energy to be able to have the effort, the intelligence, the organization to compile these things, redact them, and so on and so forth. It was an astonishing piece of work. So these first two forms of knowledge, what's ditta, what's seen and what's heard, then in these ones we're starting with physical senses and we're moving towards a much more kind of subtle or much more evocative kind of thing, a way of knowing which is much more internal, much more reflective, but still only to a fairly small degree. Because things which we have as our views or the things that we've learned through our tradition are usually things which people don't reflect about very much. They're things which we just kind of carry or we can do. You know, we can sit when we're kids and we can learn the times tables or whatever it is. And it doesn't necessarily mean very much. And I'm always struck how so many people seem to have so little integration between the different parts of their learning. So, you know, we go to school and we learn mathematics and we learn science and we learn how to, you know, argue things logically and so on and so forth. But it seems like as soon as people step out of the classroom, they just completely forget all of that and just come up with the most amazing irrationalities and have no ability to actually join these two things together. I mean, we all do that to some degree. We all have these different compartments in our mind, but I'm often very struck at how badly we integrate these different things. I think it's possibly because of the tendency of education is always to specialize rather than to integrate. So that faculty of the mind which will help to integrate and reflect on and deepen those things is the third factor that we're talking about, is the mutta, is the thought. Okay, so this is the activity of the mind to think about things, work them over, reflect on them, raise questions into consciousness, work through them in a logical way, and so on. And this is not a simple matter. It's not something which comes innately. It's something which has to be learned. Something which has to be practiced. And you know, we've all grown up in a scientific culture. We've grown up in a culture which we know that science works. And of course, science has its problems, but nobody doubts that it actually is effective at doing many of the things that it tries to do. And no one doubts that scientific method is effective for at least some things. So we learn how to think, how to reflect. We learn how to use logic, how to infer. And of course, this is something we see at the very roots of the philosophical traditions, both East and West, is this kind of groping towards rules of logic, groping towards an understanding of what kinds of things can be considered as a proof or as a valid argument or as an invalid argument. We see many of the same kinds of forms of arguments appearing both in the Buddhist scriptures and other places in India as well as in the Western philosophy. And there's some differences but many similarities as well. So this idea of thought is always something which the Buddha said is, in terms of our spiritual practice, comes after learning. So he said you hear the teaching, you memorize it, and as you memorize it, or after you've memorized it, you then reflect on the meaning of it. Turn it over in your mind, investigate it, reflect on it. What does this mean? What does that mean? How does this bit fit in with that? What does that word exactly mean? How does that concept that was used there seems to be contradictory with the one that's used over there. How do they fit together? And so we learn to tell ourselves a story about the Dhamma. We explain the Dhamma to ourselves in our minds. We turn it over and get this kind of narrative. And that narrative, and going over that narrative and refining it, is how the human mind learns to make sense of things. You're gradually learning to internalize them. And I think it's very important to emphasize that this is essential. It's inevitable and it's essential. It's how the human mind works. Very often you hear from meditation circles, they basically say, don't think. And so thinking is, you get this idea that thinking is somehow wrong or is useless. It's not wrong, it's not useless. But the problem is not that it's wrong or it's useless. The problem is that we don't go beyond it. Is that we remain stuck at that just thinking about things, and we don't take it to the next step. So we should try to train our thinking. We should try to be more honest in the way that we work things out. We should learn to discern. For example, if we're thinking about Dhamma, we should be able to discern whether our thinking is fueled by defilements. Are we just trying, for example, to twist the Dhamma to justify our own greed, hatred and delusion? Are we thinking about Dhamma in a way that's justifying our own laziness or our own particular choices? And so we should, you know, keep on coming back to that, keep on inquiring and keep on returning to the source, returning to the text, what the Buddha was teaching, and trying to work these things out. So for example, when I was first encountered Buddhism, I practiced with the Mahasi tradition, and of course they have this view which they share, which is that you don't need jhanas, and that pleasure is an obstacle to practice. And so, you know, I just inherited this from my teachers and held it as a view for a while. And then I started reading the suttas, and of course every second sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya is talking about jhanas. So I was just inquiring, and I asked my teacher at the time, you know, what does this mean? Why is this the case? And they said, well, it's because the jhanas is what the Buddha did before he got enlightened, but not what he taught people after he was enlightened. That was the answer that I got, and I thought, oh, really? Oh, that doesn't seem quite right to me, but anyway. So then my sort of life went on, and practice went on, and so on, and you know, you've got these kind of ideas, and then gradually you encounter more different kinds of teachings, and sort of read the suttas, and do your own practice, and so on and so forth. And so gradually began to more question these ideas. And after a while of then starting to do samatha practice and so on, and beginning to realize that this kind of so-called addiction to pleasure wasn't really a problem in meditation, but actually was something that was very useful, and beginning to do that. But it was for many years that I still really didn't resolve in my own mind the fundamental question, which is, do you really need jhanas in order to get enlightened? Because this being one of the basic claims of the Vipassana schools, you don't need jhanas. And course, I'd been originally conditioned by the Mahasi school, even though I'd stayed with Ajahn Brahm for a number of years. I still wasn't 100% convinced that jhanas were really necessary. It wasn't until I went to Malaysia and people were asking these, and then I went on and did more research and looking at the suttas and so on, and then finally became quite convinced that this was necessary, and this was what of course came out of my first book, A Swift Pair of Messengers. So that book was really the outcome of many years of study, practice, inquiry, discussion. And, you know, in all of that time, even though I had, at any one particular time, I had my own opinion about it, but those opinions are always subject to questioning, subject to review, subject to revision. There comes a time when you're doing this that, I think there comes a time when your views basically mature. Since that time, even though I've been in still many discussions and so on about these topics, I haven't seen any reason to change my views. In fact, everything that I've seen since then has tended to confirm the fact that the conclusions I made at that time were quite correct. So it seems to me that there's this kind of period of questioning, inquiry and so on, with kind of a relatively loose holding to the views, and then there comes a time when they become more firm. It's not necessarily firm in a dogmatic way, but just firm in a sense of being confident about them. So this is that process of mutta, which is thought and reflection and inquiry. Not in a way that's divorced from practice, not just a purely theoretical thing, but in a way that's making sense of practice, a way of making sense. How does the practice relate to the theory? How does what is talked about in the texts relate to what happened to me in my meditation? What does what this particular teacher say relate to what that teacher's saying, and so on and so forth? If we don't do that, if we kind of repress that tendency, you typically end up being both ignorant and dogmatic. You just end up with a set of views which you've arrived at fairly randomly because, well, you happen to encounter one particular teacher rather than another particular teacher or something like that, and because you're not used to looking at different ways of seeing things, you tend to get very dogmatic about it. And we can see this very often in spiritual practitioners. So it's important to not neglect that period of inquiry, and also to respect the fact that that might take years before it reaches a relatively stable position of knowledge, not a completely stable, but a relatively confident position. So as I said, in my own case, in these questions of samatha and vipassana and the role of jhanas and so on, it was about like 7 or 8 years. And then I came to a reasonably firm conclusion, and I haven't really changed my mind since then. So you don't need to be afraid that by questioning, inquiring and so on, that this is necessarily going to be an endless process. It's a process which, if you use your wisdom and discernment, will go on as long as it needs to. And so this is where you can see the difference with if the doubting becomes chronic, and you can't stop yourself from doubting things, then that becomes a problem. But as the Buddha said, to doubt in a doubtful matter, there's nothing wrong with that. That actually just increases your wisdom. You learn to inquire more, you learn to look at things, you learn to try to understand them. So to doubt in something that's doubtful, there's nothing wrong with that, and we shouldn't be in a hurry to kind of push that process to its end, to let it take its own time. If we don't do that, then what tends to happen is the mind becomes brittle, you sort of push away all the kind of the doubts and so on, but then they really kind of remain there, and eventually they'll come back. So the fourth kind of knowing it talks about in this group is the vinyata, which is of course the most interesting and the most subtle, but the one which is least which is hardest to talk about. The vinyata, what is cognized, refers to this simple and very most fundamental quality of awareness itself, just knowing. So it's a vinyana that just knows all of these other things. And it's the emphasis on this last quality, that's the pure awareness, which is really distinguishes Indian philosophy from Western philosophy, or Indian spiritual practice from Western spiritual practice, even down to this very day. Western psychology and philosophy is still very much concerned with, you know, thinking, emotions, ideas, and so on, the contents of consciousness rather than the awareness itself. And from a very early time, long before the Buddha, the Indian sages were so fascinated by this question of what is awareness? What does it mean to actually be aware, to actually know? Now, it's a truism to say that in Buddhism, this vinyata is the most powerful form of knowing. This is what our meditation is about, is trying to learn to be directly aware, to know exactly that, what is in front of us, what is actually present in consciousness. So the practice of meditation, we identify that there are certain things which obscure this awareness. And so the Buddha said these, what he called the upakilesas, the defilements which come into the mind, which are present in the mind from time to time. And these things darken the quality of awareness. And through our meditation practice, through what the Buddha called citta bhavana, the cultivation of the mind, we remove gradually these defilements or these darkening qualities. The mind becomes more clear, more bright, and we know better. The vijnana becomes more clear gradually. All those things which are present in consciousness become more present. The focus of awareness becomes more steady. The quality and the breadth of awareness becomes more apt. We focus on what needs to be focused on, less distracted by other things. And since this vijnana, or this quality of knowing, is the most fundamental quality of the mind, it means that as this becomes purified, all of the other forms of knowing also become better. We think better, we learn better, our views and our opinions become better, the things we perceive through the senses become sharper. You've all experience this is when you're sitting meditation, and after you're sitting even for a short time, you'll notice that sounds which you previously didn't notice suddenly come to the fore. You can hear much more clearly. And so this is your quality of vijnana, that's your sota vijnana becoming purified. And the experiences in your body, the sensations and energies and so on in your body which you'd never noticed before and suddenly become very apparent, and this is your kaya vijnana becoming clear, becoming better. So through practice of meditation, our awareness becomes better, becomes more clear, and that brings all of these other things together. So the Buddha used the simile that vijnana is like the lord of the city that sits in the middle of the crossroads. So it's a very important image. So Vijnana as the lord of the city is where all of the information, the messengers come to give information to the lord of the city if he wants to find out what's going on. Can't rely on Twitter and Facebook to give him information. Messengers have to come in, so they come through the different parts of the city and they all converge in that middle, just as the six senses or the five external senses all converge on consciousness. And so this is why we so much emphasize on this present moment awareness in Buddhism. There's this development in meditation. But it's important to remember that even though this is the most profound and the most direct way of knowing, the way that leads is like the central aspect of the path towards deep realization. But it only does that in conjunction with all of the other parts. It's, as long as we're seeing these other things as opposed to it, okay, if we're seeing that there's a conflict between practice and study, for example, if we see that there's a conflict between thinking and the quietness of the mind, then that's telling us, the fact that we see that there's a tension there tells us that our minds are not integrated. It tells us that these things have not all found their proper place. As the path progresses and the path deepens, all of these things become integrated. They all have their role to play. The external senses, the basic senses that we perceive the world in, they have their proper role to play. The learning and the study that we do has its proper role to play. The discussion, the thought and the reflection, that has its proper role to play. And the awareness of the present moment in meditation, that also has its proper role to play. So this is this integrative aspect of practice and of the path. There's no kind of formula for that. There's just a gradual maturing of it. It's so important to recognize this and to not let these different aspects become in conflict, to not erect in your mind ideas that oppose these things one to the other. They don't oppose each other. It's only a view. We can have a view which sets these things against each other. But if your practice is going in a healthy way, these things will always be open to each other and they will speak to each other. As long as we're afraid of our thinking mind, we try to shove it aside, then it's always this kind of waiting to get back in. So this is what we should always be looking for in terms of being able to evaluate and to assess a kind of the success in our meditation as it becomes deeper and deeper. Meditation, but spiritual practice more generally, is do these things work together? Are they conflicting? Or are they in harmony? Are they supporting each other? And it's actually quite a wonderful feeling when you first can notice this, you know. And if you've practiced for many years, it's quite, well, not even many years, if you practice even meditation even once, you know how annoying the thinking mind is, how distracting it is from your meditation. But it's really wonderful when you get to that spot when you've had a beautiful, peaceful meditation and the mind's very quiet and doesn't need to think. But if you want to, you can turn it to contemplate an aspect of Dhamma, and you can pick up an aspect of Dhamma and look at it and reflect on it in such a clear and calm way. Everything becomes so clear. And it's very beautiful to use your mind in that way, to think and to reflect in that way. And then when that's finished, when you've done that enough, to then just put it aside come back to the quiet of the mind. And when you learn how to do that, then you realize that these different faculties shouldn't be at war with each other. They're different aspects of our mind, all of which need to be developed, and all of which need to be brought into integration and harmony in order for the path to be fulfilled. So this is my little talk for you this evening on these four ways of knowing. I offer this for your reflection. I'd like to invite if there's any comments or questions. Reflecting while you're doing it. If you find that, you know, your mind's too scattered to keep to a particular theme or whatever, then you're knowing that it's too scattered. But it's just something you have to learn by practicing, yeah? So it's like, how do you learn to swim? Well, you just dive in the water and see whether you drown or not. I did that once. When I was a kid, first year we went to swimming school. We learned how to swim. And that year we had a swimming pool put in our house. And then next year this springtime came around and it was hot enough to swim again, the first hot day. Jumped into the pool, but I'd forgotten how to swim. Floundering around, they had to come and drag me out. But there's no other way of doing it. You're just going to keep on doing it and checking it, but also through conversation, through asking questions and discussion.
Yeah. It's a bit confused, Bhante, just being talking about the sort of conflict between movement and integrating the thinking mind and being self-aware of the conflict.
Well, when you sit down to meditate, if your mind's thinking and you get annoyed with it, then there's a conflict.
Yeah.
If your mind's thinking and you just think, oh, well, that's how the mind is, and then it goes away, and your mind becomes quiet, then there's no conflict. Okay. Yeah. There's like a third factor. Yeah. So there's
the.
Okay, so you've got two factors. You've got the thinking, yeah,
yes.
And the awareness,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
So in one case you have the thinking and it's interfering with the awareness, and you reflect on that and you know that, right? And then you have a reactivity against it, so you have a third factor, which is the annoyance.
Mm.
Yeah? So that's a sign that it's unintegrated. Then, so that's lack of integration at one level. Yeah. So another level, what you're talking about now, is you have thinking and you have the awareness, the thinking's interfering with the awareness, but you're not annoyed by it. So that's at least that much better, isn't it? You've only got two things rather than three. Yeah?
Yes.
Yeah?
So are you sort of guaranteeing that as long as you continue not to be annoyed, that everything will be okay in the end?
Not necessarily, but I'm saying that it's at least a step along the way. Yeah? Yeah? At least you have those two things.
Yeah.
But I'm quite serious. So that's already a sign that you've accepted that situation. So at least you've got rid of that third thing. So you've only got two things now. Yeah? So that's already a good sign. So then it's just a matter of that gradually practicing and gradually letting go, and then you learn the proper place for each one. So see, the problem is, see, there's two different attitudes. One attitude is, you know, thinking is wrong and awareness is right. See, that's. But there's another attitude which is that, well, thinking has its place, awareness has its place, But the place of thinking is not in my meditation.
Mm.
Yeah? And that's a different way of looking at it, yeah? So it's that it's out of its place rather than it's a bit wrong in itself. I didn't quite say that. Yeah? I didn't say that the thinking is okay. What I said is that you understand that the thinking is out of its place, rather than thinking that the thinking is wrong in and of itself.
Yeah, what I'm saying is that the recognition that the thinking is out of place.
Yeah.
That the fact that you recognise that causes it to diminish.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, and it's not the only thing, but it's certainly very helpful. Yeah.
It seems to me it's necessary to give thinking time and place.
Uh-huh.
So,
yeah.
Because I've been recently doing it, given them my permission to think of the Buddha and Dharma as much as it wants.
Uh-huh.
Like before trying to get it properly. So
yeah.
Sort of a compromise between.
Yeah, definitely, yeah.
It's really helpful.
Yep. And that's exactly what you find in the Dvaita Vitaka Sutta, isn't it? Yeah? The Buddha saying you can think wholesome thoughts as long as he likes and it won't cause any harm.
Yeah.
But it also won't allow his mind to come to a state of tranquility. So he has to let go of it to let his mind in tranquility. But there's not this kind of criticism of thinking as such.
And then there's also the teaching that if you reflect upon a sutta and doing that reflecting, it will give rise to the cascade of peace.
Absolutely, yeah. That's right, yeah, it can be very mysterious, yeah. So you just kind of reflect on it, reflect on the patterns, and sometimes you'll see a pattern, sometimes you won't. Sometimes it's something very obvious, but often it's not.
Well, it's the best thing to do for minds in a very thinking mood, like that's just been stirred up by something.
Well, depends on situation, you're doing, and how your meditation's going. If your meditation's going well, if your mindfulness is strong, then you can just tell your mind, okay, that's enough thinking, I'm just going to meditate. If mindfulness isn't so strong, your meditation's not so powerful at the time, then you can just, if it's a wholesome topic, then you can just say, well, think about it. Get on your walking path and just kind of walk up and down and think about it until you're bored with it. If it's an unwholesome topic, then you need to do something to try and shift your mind away from it. Okay, let's finish my papers, please.
Bhagavata Dhammo Dhamma Namasana Sampadipanno Bhagavata.